Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen, made in collaboration with my friends at the amazing charity Help Musicians. In this episode, I'll be joined by a lad from Fleetwood in Lancashire. He was the youngest of nine siblings, worked in a car factory where he would entertain his fellow workers by singing with such beauty. And in a scene straight out of Hollywood, he was overheard by someone with connections to the music industry, who suggested he should audition for the Doyley Cart Opera Company. Needless to say, he won the audition, and the rest is musical history. He studied at the Royal College of Music, and alongside his pal Michael Ball, they've proven to be the Mick and Keith of musical theatre. Please welcome the very generous and lovely Alfie Bow. So Alfie, thanks very much for joining me on this podcast. I never thought it would happen in association with Help Musicians. And it's really good to see you. You're looking very well, I have to say.
Thank you so much, man. Yeah, I'm doing all right. Doing okay, thank you. It's been obviously a crazy couple of years for everybody, but you know, we're getting through it. And we're coming out at the end, hopefully, you know.
Yeah.
Some light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah.
Absolutely. So when you were a kid, was there light at the end of the tunnel then?
Yeah, I think I probably spent most of my youth in a tunnel, more often than not. It was a funny old time growing up in a big family of nine kids, I suppose. Being the youngest of nine, people think that, you know, you're the baby of the family and you're sort of, I don't know, you're going to be spoiled or something, or you're going to be the one that everyone dotes on. But in a big family, you're the one that gets sort of left to their own devices. You have a lot of time to yourself. You have a lot of time to create worlds and imagination and all that sort of stuff and create your own pastime. There was no internet, no computer games back then when I was a kid. It was pretty much spend time in the garden and get called into the house for my food when it was necessary.
Where was home?
It was Lancashire. It was northwest of England, just north of Blackpool, a little place called Fleetwood.
Yeah, of course.
And Fleetwood's it's a cute place. It's a nice old fishing town. It's a bit sort of tired now, but it's where I grew up, on like a council estate area. And yeah, it was an interesting childhood. My mother had gone through a lot, I think, having nine kids when I was born. So she had a little trials in her life that sort of affected us a little bit, but nothing major.
Were there any of the other kids musical at all?
There were, yeah. I mean, I come from a fairly musical family. My grandparents were good singers. My other grandmother played the organ in a church, and my dad was a good singer. My dad used to be able to sing quite well. He used to sing around the house all the time. His record collection was crazy. It had everything from Enrico Caruso to Slim Whitman, Glenn Miller, all that sort of stuff. It was pretty diverse. We had Elvis records in there and in some old Pink Floyd and some Squeeze. No, I'm joking.
I don't think he did.
So I did come from a bit of a musical background, musical family. And that was my education.
Sounds like a very noisy house.
It was. I say that there's nine kids in the family, but when you've got nine kids with their girlfriends or their boyfriends or their general friends coming around to the house, there was never quiet. There was always a party going on somewhere, or there was always life in the house.
Which one of the siblings did you look up to most, do you think?
As a kid, I looked up to my brother John. He left home fairly early in my life. He's literally, I think, 18 years older than me. So he left home when he was 19. And I was about 1 year old, 2 year old. And then he used to come home occasionally, but he went to join the Royal Air Force. Yeah, he was sort of like my superhero, you know. He was a martial art expert, you know, and he used to do all the karate stuff, and then he went off to be a soldier. And so as a kid, that's, you know, pretty cool to observe. And so I looked up to him a lot. I think also the fact that he was away quite often created that element of mystery about him, and I didn't really know him that well. And I wanted to get to know him. I wanted to spend time with him. He had a great sense of humour. Mm-hmm. And now that he's retired and he's moved back to my hometown, actually, and I know him more, I've become his hero, obviously. Chris, you know, that's
obviously. So you're at home, you've got all these kids running around, you've got your mum and dad holding the fort. Did you have your own room?
I didn't. Not initially, I didn't. I used to share with my brother Michael a little bit. And then gradually the girls started to get married and leave home. And so there was space that was freed up. It was, nine kids in a household with three bedrooms and one bathroom, you know. It was pretty rough, but the fight for the bathroom was ridiculous. I'll tell you a secret now. I don't know whether you can use this or not, but we used to have to sort of ration the bath water, you know, because we only had like a small tank. And so I was probably, 4 years old. My sister was 8 years old. And we'd have to share a bath together occasionally. And so to get the bath to myself, I used to have a wee in it. So I used to sit there, have a wee, and then she'd jump out like crazy. But I got the bath to myself, so it was all right.
Yeah. That's my kind of man. I love that. That's a really good idea. I would have probably done the same thing. Did you have, once you got your own room, did you have posters on the wall? Did you have your own record player?
I didn't have my own record player, but I had a little stereo, like a one-speaker cassette player that I had. But I had posters on my wall. I remember having lots of posters of trains and planes, you know, like Royal Air Force planes, because my brother was in the Air Force and I was interested in his life. I didn't really have... No, I did. I had one music poster, and it was a Status Quo poster that I put up. So yeah. I was part of the Quo Army back then, you know.
One of many.
And then I remember my mother saying, we're going to decorate your room, so go and help us take the wallpaper off. And the wallpaper that I had on at the time was Mr. Men wallpaper. And then yikes. I was getting older, so she said, we're going to make it a bit more adult for you. And I pulled off all the wallpaper. And for some reason, I just hit this sort of artistry freaking out. I don't know. I just got given these felt tip pens and marker pens. And I just went into this art explosion and I started to draw on the wall and make faces and shapes and designs and pictures of all sorts. By the end of it, it looked a real mess. My mother was furious, but I thought it was brilliant. It was like a huge like sketch pad, you know, that I was
doing, you know. Did you get a chance to make any model planes?
I made a few model planes, but I was more into my trains. I wanted to be a train driver, Chris.
You still can.
I know, I probably will after COVID, you never know. That might be it, you know. I could start on the trams in Blackpool and then develop...
Work my way up.
Yeah, I used to want to be a train driver. I think because I used to travel to Manchester a little bit on the train from Blackpool. It was the old-fashioned steam trains. And they were great, and it was lovely. You had your own little like carriage and the two bench seats facing each other, a bit like the Hogwarts Express type thing, you know?
Wonderful.
Yeah, it was. And so I used to love to, you know, go to the old train exhibitions and stand on the platforms. And I'm embarrassed about that now, that I was like a train spotter in a way. But
you shouldn't be at all.
Back then it was pretty good, you know, looking at all those. I mean, I saw the... Flying Scotsman came through Preston Station, and you know, to go down and see those big engines, you know, the power that they had was incredible.
Of course.
It was fascinating. So I had all those posters on my walls. And
you've definitely got one up on me, because I used to collect numbers off the side of buses.
Did you really?
I used to go to bus garages. In particular, Peckham. Peckham bus garage was amazing.
Mate.
It was like a cathedral of buses. It was just great.
When I'm back in the UK in September, we should go and do that. I think that'd be a really good day out. Just me and you go to a bus stop.
And busk.
Let's do it, yeah.
So your friends at school, were they into music?
No, I don't think, you know, my neighbourhood or the school that I went to really encouraged music in any way. I was never a part of a choir. There was never really any music classes or anything like that. They were mainly into football. Yeah, it was always football, being from the north, you know, so it was either you know, you're either a Man United fan or you're a Liverpool fan.
Sure.
You know, I went to school with a lot of Man United fans, and I remember going home to my mother and saying, can I support a football team? Everybody's Man United. Can I support them? And she went, well, I'll go and get you a bag from the Army surplus store. So we went to that Army and Navy store, and she picked up this little red canvas bag. And my mother used to do a lot of oil painting. She used to do a lot of portraits. So she got her oil paints out. She got this white oil paint, and she painted on this red bag, Liverpool FC. So I was the only Liverpool fan in my class, but that was it. That was me stuck for life then. So I'm a Liverpool fan. So,
how did you find your voice? Obviously, you've got a family full of people that can sing, but you've really taken it to the moon and back.
I think really my brother, Michael, was probably the first person to really dig into his singing, because he was training to be a priest. You know, we're Irish Catholic family, and my brother was going to go off and be a priest. And so for that, he used to have to join the choir and the seminary and sing a lot of stuff, and he did a few solos. And he was very good, you know, he was really good. And he still sings for a hobby now. He's got a nice voice. But he was interested in Maria Callas and all the opera works and things. So I learned a lot from him and sort of got introduced to opera, as well as my dad.
How old were you then, Alfie?
Six or seven, something like that. Okay. Yeah. I remember listening to a recording of La Boheme with a tenor called Jussi Bjørling, who was an amazing Norwegian tenor. I became quite a fan of him myself, and I used to study him at music college quite a lot. That was the first time I heard La Boheme. I didn't really think that would be the first opera that I sing professionally. But he used to get me to sing along to some of these things, and he recognised that I could hit, as a boy soprano, he recognised that I could hit these high notes. And there was one note that he asked me to hit. He said it was the highest recorded ever note, and it was a top F above top C. And I hit it. And then I went like a semitone higher. I sort of kept just going, and my voice was good as a little boy soprano. And then when it broke, I didn't really know where it was going to go. I didn't know I had that ability to sing at all. My voice broke when I was about 13. And I suppose I really sort of started to sing in private. Being a teenager, I was embarrassed about what, you know, making sounds and singing along to records and all that sort of stuff. And it was really listening to Elvis and Freddie Mercury and then listening to Caruso, Enrico Caruso, Pavarotti, and realising that I could create a sound. Didn't know whether it was good or not. I didn't know how I was creating it, but I knew I could create some sort of sound. It was interesting to me. I was sort of amazed by it, really, to be honest. It was a wakening up of something inside of me that I didn't know I had.
Wow.
To be honest, I didn't really sing much as a kid. I used to do a couple of amateur operatic performances and things. And then I sort of packed it in for a few years, because when you come from the north of England, you get told to get a trade.
Get a job,
get a proper job, and then you can go off and do what you want once you've got your trade.
And what was that proper job?
Well, my proper job was working in a car factory in Blackpool called TVR. And it was a sports car company, and I was an apprentice paint sprayer and body mechanic. And I loved it. It was great, great bunch of people to work with. It was apprentice life was fun and exciting, and lots of laughter, lots of fun things to do. But I probably didn't really work as hard as I should have done. You know, I'm not very good at that job. I couldn't go back. So that's why I could go and be a train driver, but I couldn't be a panel beater anymore.
Did you ever go and see any live music at all, like bands playing locally, that sort of thing?
I did. In Blackpool, we had this wonderful venue called the Blackpool Opera House. I'm sure you've played
beautiful.
Chris. It's a great venue to play old theatre, but it used to get lots of amazing artists there. I mean, from like Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chaplin have performed there. And then every summer we'd get like a major show from London, like a major musical. And then each weekend there'd be a different artist, like usually Tom Jones, Shirley Bassey, you know, Status Quo would come along, you know, and big names. And then the older I got, Pet Shop Boys turned up one time. That was a cool gig. I used to work there as well. I got a part-time job working in the Blackpool Opera House stage crew. So,
what was that like? Tell us who you might have met.
One guy that I met that I really admired and just saw how sort of down-to-earth he was and chilled about it. Well, he didn't even sit in his dressing room. He sat down on stage waiting to go on a chair in the corner of the room, chatting to everybody. And it was Don McLean, mm-hmm. American Pie. And a beautiful fella, wonderful guy to talk with. And I was backstage security, so I was sitting outside his dressing room, but he was never there. He was always downstairs. But one time I turned up to be dressing room security, and I didn't know who I was looking after. Went and got my seat outside the room, and they hadn't even put the names on the dressing room doors yet. Didn't even know who it was. And then one guy came and sat next to me, and he had like this slick back mop of brown hair, big guy, an old khaki army jacket on, combat trousers, big black boots. And we sat and talked, had this really strange conversation just about pizza, you know, and how to make the perfect pizza, you know. And he said, the way to make the perfect pizza, you have to get the best oven. You know, I live out in California now. I have this wonderful pizza oven in my garden, and you've got to get the best flour, finest flour, the best ingredients, and that's how you make the best pizza. And it comes out perfect. And I thought, great, that sounds amazing, man. He says, anyway, I've got to go. I'm going to go work now. And I thought he was like a roadie or a truck driver or something, or maybe their own personal security. Anyway, the concert had started, and the support act, the one guy, came out of his dressing room, and it was this tall guy with this huge black cowboy jacket on, cowboy boots, huge Stetson, Gibson guitar slung over his shoulder, and on the neck of the guitar was his name, and it said Dwayne Eddy. And it was like, oh man, I can't believe it. It's like Dwayne Eddy. And I went downstairs to watch him, and then I had to go back up and walk the other act, the main act, down to the stage. And it was just one guy at the time, but it was a duo. And I walked him down to the stage, and he walked on stage, and on the opposite side of the stage, his brother walked on.
No.
It was the guy that I was sat talking to, and it was the Everly brothers.
No way.
It was Don and Phil Everly. I was chatting to Phil Everly.
Oh, my God. They were, of course, very famous for not talking to each other.
Exactly.
A bit like Sam and Dave, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So that was an amazing night for me to be able to meet those guys and, you know, have that little piece of history to remember. It's cool.
That's a beautiful story. I mean, when you were backstage, did you think, I want to be on that stage?
Every single time I worked there. The guy that gave me the job was a wonderful fellow called John Ginley, who was like the head stage management electrician. And he put me forward for the job, and I got the job. And now he does the lights for me now. He does all my lights on my concerts.
That's beautiful. What a great thing.
But yeah, every time I used to stand up in the wings of that theatre, I just thought, I've got to be on there. I want to be on there so much, you know. And I ended up getting fired from there because we'd done so many get-ins and get-outs for the concerts. I think we had like Shirley Bassey one night, Tom Jones the next. I forget who else came in. There was another show the following night. And then coming in at the beginning of the week was the summer show of 42nd Street, the musical. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like worked all weekend, morning, noon and night, just trying to get in and get out. And I was just so tired. And when 42nd Street came in, we did the fit up. It took about 3 or 4 days to do the fit up for that. And then we started rehearsing the show because I was supposed to be crew on that. And at one point, there's a trap door that I have to open to pass this huge coin, which is like a huge dime or something, you know, and I pass it out for the dancer to take off me. And then to put on the floor and start tap dancing on it to the song We're in the Money, I think it is, in 40 seconds, you know. And I was underneath this trap door holding this coin, and I just... and I just passed out. I was out like a light. And she was like stamping on this trapdoor to wake me up to try and get a coin.
Oh my God.
And so I got fired from that place. So,
have you ever played the gig?
I've played there many times now. And I remember the first time I went back, I was doing a Friday night is music night for BBC Radio 2. And Ken Bruce was interviewing me and he said to me, I believe you used to work here. And I said, I did, mate. And he said, but what people don't know, Alfie, is that I believe you got fired from here. and I said, I did. And the fella that fired me stood in the wings. And after I finish this song, I'm going to go and smash his face in.
Have you ever been to the Waxworks in Blackpool?
I have, yeah. It's got more personality than some cabaret singers. So.
Well, if you ask the guy in the special room downstairs...
Yeah. Are you in there?
You'll see... No. You'll see Gary Glitter, yeah. Jimmy Savile.
Oh, my word.
Cliff was down there for a minute, but now he's back up.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
It's just so weird.
You'd think they'd melt those things down now, wouldn't you?
I know. Alongside our weekly guests, in each episode, we'll be meeting other musicians from around the UK who've been supported by Help Musicians during these turbulent and troubling times. These beneficiaries are singers, songwriters, composers from rock and pop and classical, and they're all here to tell their story.
I'm Kirsten Evans, and I am a composer and a vocalist, and I currently am working in installations and as a media composer for film and television. Currently in the south coast of England, the turning point for me when I was very young. I liked to sing and I went from just sort of singing in the shower and at home to thinking, actually, this is something that I want to do every day. And I basically just never stopped learning about music and I've come to the point where I am at now. I emailed a Swedish composer called John Ekstrand and to my delight and surprise, he replied to me and he actually said, yes, would you like to come out to Sweden for 10 days as a trial run? And passed my 10-day trial, and John invited me back to be his assistant, actually. I then got to work on amazing projects, which then culminated in us both working on the new Marvel film, Morbius, and it's coming out in 2022, and it basically just came from a cold email that I sent to John. I had to move back from Sweden to the UK as a direct result of the pandemic, unfortunately, and I also had to put off my plans to move to Los Angeles to continue my film composition. When I had to leave Sweden, I basically had 3 days to pack up all of my stuff and catch the last commercial flight back to the UK. So I had to then set up a temporary workstation in my mum's house, and there have been a lot of unexpected things that have happened. But for me personally, I've been very lucky that the good have outweighed the bad. In 2018, Help Musicians gave me some funding towards an installation that I was putting together. So when I received funding from Help Musicians, it meant that I could actually bring one of my biggest ideas to fruition. So my installation was aimed at children, and it was basically there to introduce them to the families of the orchestra through play. Because Help Musicians also coached me through the various aspects of a project at the same time, they helped me with my budgeting, they helped me with my planning and my timelines. It meant that I then had enough experience to then go out and do these things on my own. Help Musicians really can propel a small artist to a point where others are more interested in their work and others are more excited about this artist's work. For me, the funding from Help Musicians was more or less the key to me being able to do what I wanted to do from that point onwards.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. So how did you get from there to the Royal College of Music?
At the same time as working at the Blackpool Opera House, I was doing my apprenticeship job. And I remember riding to work one day on my bike, and I just had this urge to sing again. I'd not really sung for a couple of years. I'd not really done anything because I wanted to concentrate on my apprenticeship. But I still had this, I don't know, I just still had this buzz inside me. And I remember waking up one morning and it was like somebody had ignited a flame. That's the only way I can describe it. It was like I couldn't get this feeling of wanting to sing out of my head. I remember riding to work, having that feeling, having that buzz. And I made a phone call at work to a friend of mine who was connected with local amateur operatics. And I said to her, I said, is there anyone around that are doing a show that need singers? And she said to me, yeah. She said, as a matter of fact, there's a company in Preston that are doing a production of West Side Story. Why don't you come along tonight, actually, and see what you think? So I went along and I just got the buzz. It was like something that just clicked for me. I thought, this is what I want to do. And doing that show was something else because I just wanted to be one of the Jets or one of the Sharks. That was all. I didn't want to do a main role. I didn't want to, just wanted to get in there and sing. But everybody started to kick up a fuss because they'd already cast the lead roles of Tony and Maria. And they all kicked up a fuss and wanted to audition, wanted the chance to try and do the roles. So the MD said, you know what, I'm sick of you all complaining. Everyone come into the back room now. All the guys line up and I want you to sing the song Maria. Everybody at once. That was like one of the craziest auditions to do, is like just to try and hear everybody at once singing the song Maria. So the piano player started to play it and I started to sing it with everybody. And there's an alternate line in the middle of it where you can keep repeating the word Maria, you know, so it's like, Maria, 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 Maria. And, you know, doing all that and they're just repeating the word. Or you can go, Maria, 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 Maria. Or you can hold the big top note. And that was the only version I knew because I'd listened to Jose Carrera sing it, you know? So that was what I did. By the end of the time that I'd held the note, everyone else had stopped singing. And I carried on singing the rest of it. I was so embarrassed. But in the end, they gave me the role of Tony. So wow. I played the role of Tony. And then I had a couple of singing lessons with a great guy called Lawrence Nunes, who was a local singer. And then you sing around the factory. And then at one point, this guy was buying a car from the factory and overheard me singing and said, you've got a good voice. You should do something with it. There's an audition going on in London for the next UK tour of the Doyley Cart Opera Company. And the Doyley Cart were a company that were specialised in Gilbert and Sullivan operas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I took the day off work, came down to London, never auditioned for a professional company before, and stood in my work boots, jeans and a sweatshirt, and stood on stage and sang the only classical song that I really knew, which was a song that my dad used to play a lot called You Are My Heart's Delight by Franz Lehár. It was a really cool moment. I loved it. And I just sang it with everything that I got. I had a phone call the following week. My dad and my mum were sat in the living room waiting for the phone to ring and wait for the answer of whether I got the job or not. And they said they wanted to offer me a place in the chorus. And I accepted it, and that was it. I handed in my notice. My dad was thrilled. He was tears in his eyes, and my mother was beside herself. And so I did a year with the Doyley Cart, and then I decided to either continue performing professionally or to go and study. And I got a job in the West End in Phantom, and then I also gained a place at the Royal College of Music. So I didn't take the job in Phantom. I went to the Royal College of Music for 4 years and then the National Opera Studio and learned how to sing, really, and learned how it all worked and lots of different repertoire, lots of different styles, and just really, really absorbed music for the first time in my life. It was amazing.
It must be, I would imagine, a massive discipline.
It is at a place like the Royal College of Music. Everything is focused around classical music, so you really have to throw yourself in it fully. And I think because I had the ability to sing, it sort of came easy to me to be able to produce the notes, to be able to produce the sound, to but to also work on the craft, work on the languages, on the styles of different classical music, from oratorio to opera to baroque to whatever it was, you know, that had to sing at the time.
Do you ever get a gig where you get a piece of music put in front of you and you go, oh, not that again?
Les Miserables.
You must know it inside out, top to bottom.
I do know it inside out. I've got a fair.
How many times have you done it?
Oh, man, I don't know. I mean, I think over 1,000 at least. I think I've done over 1,000 performances of it. Must have now.
And is that with Cameron McIntosh? Is he a big fan of yours?
He is. And you know what? And I love Cameron. Cameron's a great guy. He's a wonderful producer. This time for him throughout the pandemic has been so hard, but I've got so much respect for him because despite all the barriers that were put in front of him, he constantly kept trying to resurrect theatre or bring it back in some form. We did 10 performances of Les Mis last December before we had to close because it went into a tier 3 lockdown. But he was trying constantly to keep theatre alive. And yeah, I've got a lot of respect for him, and he's always taken very good care of me and been a wonderful fella. To be able to sing a piece like that and to be known for it, to have the credibility that I've gained from it. And also the knowledge, you know, I've learned a lot from that piece. You know, I've learned a lot about, not just about musical theatre or about composition or about the composers or the way that that world works, but I've learned a lot about myself as well in the characters.
Interesting.
You know,
Yeah. I know that you write songs, Alfie. I've heard quite a few of them and they're brilliant. And when did the songwriter come along?
I've been writing for a while, but I've never been in a position to release any original material. As it happens, I think I've found myself locked into a bracket where people know you for a certain thing, and if you try and break out of that box, it can be quite tricky. But again, this last 2 years, this last 18 months of this pandemic has given me the opportunity to write a lot more, you know, and to improve it. The songs that you maybe heard were very early, early stages, and I've been writing pretty much every day since we first went into lockdown. And I've had a lot to write about and a lot to think about.
You know, that's your audience. They want to know about Alfie.
Yeah.
They want to hear the stories like we've just heard. You know, it's a fascinating journey that you've had and still maintain to have. And really, when you play in front of people, that's what they want to hear.
Well, they'll hear next year a full album, 12 original songs on an album that I've been writing. But in total, I've written, in the last 12 months, I think I've written about 72 songs. I mean, that for me is a lot. I mean, to these professional guys who write 2 or 3 songs a day, that's nothing. But I've been working with some wonderful writers, people that have taught me a lot and inspired me and listened to my story. And we've worked on lyrics together, we've worked on melodies together. And I'm desperate now because I was always a bit timid. You run that writing school, you know, that writing course. I was always a bit timid of taking part in it because I didn't think I was capable, to be honest, Chris. Keeping my head above water would be frightening. And it was, but now I'm in a place where I get so excited to write and so excited to collaborate with other people and hear their experiences and their ability for melodies and things. So I'd love to
do that.
That's
great.
Yeah.
That's great. Outside of singing in English, what is your other favourite language to sing in? What's the most passionate language, do you think?
Well, passionate-wise, I think Italian is obviously everything. When it comes to opera, people think Italian opera, so romantic, so evocative with the language and all that sort of stuff. But there's one language that I absolutely adore to sing in because it's just as romantic as Italian, and that's Russian. The Russian language is, I mean, you've got these such wonderful melodies by Tchaikovsky and Rimsky-Korsakov, and when you put the lyrics to those, and even though it's very guttural, a little bit like German, but even though it's very guttural, once you hit that vowel sound, the language and the romance and the story just blossoms, and it's a wonderful, wonderful language to sing in. So I used to love to do Russian operas, a lot of Russian repertoire when I was at college. I used to learn them phonetically and then get the translation, understand what you're singing about. There's nothing worse than singing about somebody dying when you've got a big smile on your face. Unless you're a villain, you know, that's not a bad thing.
So you can sing in Russian, but you can't have a conversation in
Russian? Not really. I can understand the language to listen to, but to have a conversation is tricky. I'd like to learn it fully. I'd like to take the time to really learn Russian. I understand and can speak Italian a little bit and French, but the languages we had to learn at college were incredible. I mean, we had to learn, obviously, English was the first language for a lot of repertoire. Italian, French, German, Spanish, Russian, Czech. And then I had to do an opera in Korean. So I had to learn Korean. And then I had to do a recital of Japanese song. So I had to learn a lot of Japanese song, which, incidentally, Japanese is very close to Italian because it's all on the vowels, you know?
I never knew that.
Yeah, it's a real cool language to sing in as well.
That's amazing. God. God, you really can sing in different languages. So tell me where you think your sort of high point has been along the journey so far. Will you look back?
Well, apart from this podcast today, Chris, I've had many, many, many high points that I can recall. There's obviously being asked to perform for the royal family and perform for Her Majesty's Diamond Jubilee and then her birthday, and to be able to be part of that is amazing. So we've done the 25th anniversary of Les Mis, again, put me on the map and sort of really put me in front of a lot of people's eyes and from around the world, you know. It was wonderful. Those are the main ones for me. Playing Broadway Broadway was an amazing thing. To get a Tony Award from my first performance on Broadway was nice.
Incredible, Alfie.
Thank you. You know, one of the things that I really love to do, and I've been recognised for that as well with my OBE, but doing a lot of charity work, doing a lot of charity events, and getting to meet the people that you're helping really is a highlight, you know.
Yeah.
Doing things like Festival of Remembrance as well. When you're on an event like that, it's not about you. You're just there to sort of paint a picture of somebody else's struggle or somebody else's trial through a battle or whatever it was, or through their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to meet all the military men and women, all the veterans, performed in the Memorial Day concert over here in the States, and again, getting to meet soldiers that came back injured and all the old veterans and people like that. It's a great honour. So those are big highlights for me.
Yeah.
As well, you know.
So if a highlight is like Broadway, which it would be for me if I was in your shoes, what would you say was the lowest point?
Oh, lowest point in my career or in my life in general, I think.
No, just in your career. I don't want to get personal.
You don't want to get personal. Okay. In my career, lowest point. There have been shows that I've not enjoyed doing. There's been productions that, you know, I've had to go through, I've had to push through, and it's been a slog. It's like any other job. You don't get on with everybody you work with. That's life. And so I've had to sort of do jobs that I've not really wanted to do or sing with somebody, and that's been a pretty low point and very depressing.
Yeah.
It gets you down. When you just want to entertain and you just want to bring happiness to people, and you've got somebody that you have to work with that doesn't really consider you or anyone else,
sure.
It's a bit hard, you know.
I can imagine.
It's tough. And I'm not talking about Michael Ball, by the way. I swear.
I was.
I've got to say, working with Michael has been a wonderful time. Obviously, in any partnership, you know that it has its ups and downs. But when we first teamed up, it was a challenge. We wanted to sort of get the measure of each other and see where we got. But we've got to a place now where we have this mutual respect and we know what each other brings to the table. And when we're together, we work hard and pull it out the bag and we have a laugh now.
So you see each other's similarities and your differences.
Yeah, we do. You know, initially it was a bit tough at the beginning, and then we had exciting moments right at the beginning when it was really a success. And we're still having that success now, you know.
It's an amazing thing. So Help Musicians is a charity that has been going for 100 years, started by Edward Elgar and his mates at the time. And over the pandemic, they gave out £17 million to songwriters who were on their arse, basically, and in dark places. Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of the charity. I'm aware of Edward Elgar. I've sung a lot of his music, but I wasn't aware of the charity until I got the information through for the podcast. But yeah, I mean, that's amazing, the work that the charity's doing to keep music alive and keep creativity alive and to help, you know, the mental state of musicians, because, you know, we're a funny old breed, Chris, you know.
We are.
You know, we work on our emotions, and our emotions sometimes get the better of us and can send us spiraling or can send us flying, you know. And when you're a creative, like the writers that I've met over the last couple of years, I can see how hard and how sort of a dark place they can fall into, you know. So it's important and it's incredible that a charity like this can do fundamental work, you know.
Yeah, they've been doing a lot of work with classical musicians, and just recently I was introduced to a classical pianist who managed to achieve some funding from Help Musicians. And I'd never worked with a classical pianist before. He was quite a young lad, and he'd never written a song, but we talked about Stephen Sondheim, and I sort of guided him towards some of his more powerful lyrics, I guess. And I was astonished at the quality of music this guy came back with. Just blew me away.
It's incredible what's inside musicians and what, you know, people like yourself can bring out of each other, you know, what we can all bring out of each other if we work at it. And I'm amazed. I'd like to hear some of that.
I'll introduce you to him. So who do you lean on when times get tough, Alfie?
I've got a close family. I've got brothers and sisters that I'm really close to, and I've needed them this last 2 years, needed them a lot. You know, as well, though, I know we don't talk much, but I, you know, people like yourself, Chris, I know I can always rely on you. You know, I can always, like, pick up the phone and say, look, I'm going to be back in town, can we meet for a coffee or whatever, you know? And I've got good support. I've got good friends. This last 2 years, I've gone through a big personal shift, which hasn't been nice. Unfortunately, parted ways with my wife, but it's amicable. And
I'm sorry to hear that, Alfie.
Yeah, no, it's okay. But I am cut up about it. I'm pretty sad about it. But I love her very much, and she's a wonderful woman. She's a great mother. She was a wonderful wife, and I wish her nothing but happiness. And I'm always going to be there for her.
But, that's a lovely thing to say.
Oh, thank you. So I've had to rely on a lot of people, really, other than herself, because she was my go-to. She was the person that I would call and, you know, moan at. and she always says that I still can, but which is nice. So my family, my brothers, my sisters, I've got close friends, you know, yourself, Chris, Michael Ball even, he's a good guy to chat with. He likes to tell you what you should do and things, you know. Well, you should be doing this and you should be doing that.
Is there a song, Alfie, that when you're singing, it can almost bring you to tears?
Well, lately there's a few songs that I've written that do that. And I didn't think I would ever be in that position to have written a song with a colleague that can tell a story of my life that I've been going through that brings me to tears. But songs that I've sung in the past, and it's a song that I've sung millions of times, it's Bringing Home from Les Miserables. People say, you must get sick of that song. And I never do. You know, it's a prayer. It's like a moment to say a prayer. And, you know, I haven't prayed in years, Chris. And so the only time I get to do it is when I sing Bringing Home sometimes. And I should probably do it a bit more. But, you know, in my need, you have always been there. That's one of the lines in it. You know, if I die, let me die. Let him live. And it's sacrificing yourself for somebody else's happiness and peace. So it is a strong, powerful song, and it always brings a tear to my eye if it's sung properly, if I do it properly, and I really try and do it every time.
Amazing.
One of the other songs that gets me that I always, always break down at is a funny old one to sing, but it's Love Rain on Me by The Who. You know,
That's an interesting one.
Yeah, whenever I sing that one, I think because in the story of Quadrophenia, when Jimmy is going through that moment, it's like a real recognition of his life is changing. the world is changing, people around him are changing. And it's acceptance of a new world, it's acceptance of a new life. And he just wants to be loved and he just wants to be liked. His parents have kicked him out. He just wants to be connected and wants to have friends. And he realizes that that's what life is like now. It's not about being rebellious or being riotous or losing his way or falling off the edge or whatever. It's about growing up. And no matter how old we are, I think we always have to learn that lesson that it's, we're always growing up. We're always growing up throughout our whole lives. You know, I don't think you ever stop learning. You're constantly recovering or getting over mistakes that you've made, you know, yeah, learning from them.
Alfie, we're always growing up, but we always want to drive the train.
Exactly. Exactly, man. That's a lyric for you if I've ever heard one.
So thank you for taking the time to be on this podcast. And you're a lovely man, Alfie, and I'll see you at Peckham bus station in a few months' time.
Definitely will.
God bless.
Bless you, man. God bless.
God bless you. What an amazing life story that man has had. I really hope that he puts pen to paper and makes some songs out of it. As always during these chats, I find myself being full of joy having spoken to people about their journey. And Alfie was very honest, I thought. I love chatting to him. He's such a lovely bloke. Of course, we do have some things in common, but I have to say, I've never been on stage with Michael Ball. At least not yet. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. See you on the next episode and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.